So, what's the starting point? Well, in a way, the reason, I guess, why we are all in this business, and that is the fact that nature has served us some quite enormous mysteries, if you want. Headaches, you could also say. And, well, basically, the big mystery is why are things the way they are? So, among these things that are the way they are is the standard model, which happens to have a gauge group SU3, SU2 times U1. There's a whole bunch of parameters of the standard model as well, like particle masses, also quite mysterious. Like, for example, the mass ratio of the muon to the electron is something like 200, I think 205 or something. Why is that? An even bigger mystery, perhaps, is the value of the electroweak scale. Which is about 10 to the minus 32 times the Planck scale. So why is that, and in particular, why is it such a small number, right? So we seem to have some fine-tuning here. And an even bigger mystery, the king of all mysteries, the mother of all mysteries, is of course the cosmological constant problem, right? Cosmological constant lambda has this ridiculously small but non-zero value of 10 to the minus 120 times m Planck to the fourth. Okay. That's not just fine-tuning, that's, you know, ridiculous fine-tuning. So for the second guy, the electroweak scale, well, there you can sort of offer some natural explanation or maybe some way at least to postpone the problem, and that is, so for the second one here, you can say, well, it may be that there's actually supersymmetry just above the electroweak scale at 1 TeV, say. So if that's the case, then you can actually fairly naturally get this value for the electroweak scale. So if supersymmetry is, you know, at 1 TeV, right around the corner, then this fine-tuning problem, if you want, gets ameliorated to something like this, 10 to the minus 2. Susie, right? So then, well, you still actually do have to do some fine tuning. It's like, you know, at the 1% level if you take everything into account, but it's less. Now, on the other hand, at this point, experimentally, there's just no trace whatsoever of supersymmetry, and actually it's getting some kind of somewhat worrisome because, there have been a number of precision experiments, for example, that really should have shown supersymmetry by now, or at least some indication of it, and there's nothing whatsoever. So it's not at all clear that it's really there, and that it's really there to explain this hierarchy. Moreover, you know, even if it is there, even if there is low energy supersymmetry, then still you would face, you know, you would have to explain why the supersymmetry breaking scale then is of the order of 10 to the minus 30 and Planck squared, right? Now you may in certain models invent plausible mechanisms that give this large hierarchy, but you you do have to come up with some mechanism. And actually, from what we seem to be learning now from string theory and so on, these models are not particularly natural. So we're still stuck, basically, with some fine-tuning problem. All right. What makes this all the more amazing is that, you know, in a way, we're really lucky bastards. Because if these parameters had been a little bit different, we just wouldn't have been here. So for example, well, this is so. So there's this famous Weinberg bound on the cosmological constant. And that tells basically that the cosmological constant had to be between -10^-120 and Planck to the fourth, and something like 10^-118 and Planck to the fourth in order to have galaxy formation. If we had been below this value on the negative side, well, then the universe would have recollapsed a long time ago in a big crunch. There would just not have been enough time to develop galaxies, stars, planets, and us. We definitely wouldn't have been here sitting right now. If it had been above this bound, then the universe would have been accelerating so fast that all matter would have been blown apart before it could actually clump together and start forming structure. So there wouldn't have been galaxies either. And the universe would have been just some cold collection of scattered hydrogen atoms. Right. So we happen to be right in that window. Amazing coincidence. A similar thing, actually, as it emerged more recently, is true for the electroweak scale. So if the electroweak scale had been, you know, just a factor of 5, or like, let's say, one order of magnitudes, bigger or smaller, so different, then you find that actually you cannot form complex atoms, or more precisely, only hydrogen and helium. Right. So the reason for that is the reason why, you know, complex nuclei can actually assemble is really thanks to a very delicate balance of the masses of the neutron and proton. If it had been a little bit different, then, yeah. I don't know. I wouldn't think it would be too sensitive, because that's mainly a gravitational thing, but I don't know that. All right, so if this mass balance had been a little bit different, for example, the proton wouldn't have been stable if it had been too heavy. So it would decay to a neutron, so you couldn't have atoms. The other way around, if the proton had been much lighter than the neutron, then similarly, you couldn't keep the nuclei together. Anyway, so this has been emphasized in particular by Nima Arkani-Hammad and Savas Dimopoulos more recently. They call this, well, this they call the structure principle, this they call the atomic principle, or something like that. But again, we see we have this amazing coincidence, if you want, right in this window where we can actually exist. So that, of course, prompts the question, why has the Lord been so kind? Okay. So, where could we try to find the answer? Well, it's definitely not going to come from quantum field theory, because there, these parameters are just input, right? Now, on the other hand, we know more than quantum field theory, we know string theory, and there, well, there are no external parameters. Everything we observe is, in principle, dynamically determined. So you may wonder, well, could string theory maybe provide the answer then? Well, who knows? So most optimistically, you could say, well, maybe there is only one vacuum of string theory. Well, it's by now, of course, extremely clear that that's definitely not the case, because, for example, flat space, flat 10-dimensional space, is definitely an exact solution of string theory. Radius 5 times S5, some flux n, gives, in fact, an infinite number of exact solutions to string theory for which we even have a non-perturbative description from radius CFT. Then, of course, there are various Calabi-Yau compactifications, which are also firmly established, and so on. So clearly, there is an enormous amount of vacua that are there. So this naive hope definitely is not fulfilled. But now you might say, oh, well, but OK, these things don't look like the real world at all, right? I mean, here, clearly, the dimension is wrong. Same for this guy, right? This guy has the additional problem. So this has some, if you want, four-dimensional cousins, ADS4. Well, as a compactification of M-theory, for example, ADS4 times some Einstein 7 manifold, that is for improving compactifications. But they all share the problem, similar to this one, that the radius of the ADS is of the order of the radius of the 5-sphere. So there's actually no proper way in which you could call these things really compactifications. Both these spaces are, in a sense, equally large. So that's no good. Then these guys, well, they come always with tons of moduli. Okay. Massless fields, massless scalars. They're clearly not there. You don't observe them. So you can exclude those vacua easily as well. So that, I guess, made some people hope then, well, maybe there's only one vacuum that has a large 4D part, right, as opposed to these guys, and no massless moduli. Now, this also turned out to be wishful thinking of some. At least by now, it is reasonably well established that there are tons of generic n equals 1 compactifications. Right? So, well, the guys I wrote down here, up here, are higher supersymmetry, n equals 2 Ds, and so on. But as soon as you go down to n equals 1, you typically get potentials for the moduli, they can either come from classical effects, such as fluxes, or they can come from non-perturbative quantum effects, instanton effects, and so on. So generically, you'll get potential moduli get lifted, and you end up with a huge number of vacua that actually do satisfy this condition. Now, this was probably, there was for a long time a sneaky suspicion that this would be the case, but it was by far not established. But that changed in 2003, I think, with the work of Kacur, Kalos, Linde, and Trivedi, who actually gave a scenario for concrete construction of these vacua. In a controlled regime. So that had been the problem before, to really show that these existed in a controlled regime. Okay. So they proposed a scenario. It took a while to find concrete examples, mainly because of technical difficulties. By now, at least in my opinion, for the supersymmetric version of the KKLT vacuum, vacuum with n equals 1, it's shown beyond reasonable doubt that these things really exist. Of course, what reasonable doubt means is sort of subjective, but I don't think many people doubt about the fact that these things are real, or at least are part of string theory. Okay. So not only are there, examples, there are gigantic amounts of examples. So the numbers of these vacua are that, well, for a fixed topology of a compactification manifold, even get numbers of like 10 to the 100s, and so on, 10 to the 300, 500, even more. So the reason why you get these large degeneracies is the fact that you can turn on fluxes, and you can turn on many fluxes, and so you get like a whole bunch of integers that you can change, and each of them, each discrete choice, gives rise to a different vacuum with different properties. So one of the topics of these lectures will be to make that more precise and, to explain you how people get to this number, for example. But for now, take my word, there's a lot of them. Okay, so, well, take one step back even and say, well, okay, but those vacua are supersymmetric. Therefore, they have negative cosmological constant, they're ADS spaces. Now, we live in a universe with a positive cosmological constant, so metastable the sitter. So perhaps that's the key. Maybe there's only one vacuum that has all these properties, but on top of that also, positive cosmological constant, so broken supersymmetry, which is, of course, also a fact of life, and so on. All right, now, KKLT also, in their scenario, went on, and they also offered a way to construct, actually, the sitter vacua in string theory. But this is less well established, or perhaps not established. So in terms of a concrete model where you can really show that this is sitter vacuum realized and that everything is stable and so on. So the reason why this is much more difficult is our stability issues, right? So for a supersymmetric vacuum, there's not much to check in terms of stability, but for a non-supersymmetric one, in particular one with a positive cosmological constant, well, you have to basically check that there are no tachyons. You have to, check all possible decay channels, which can, involve the original zero modes you have. It can also involve higher KK modes and so on. So it's technically extremely difficult. And so in principle, this could still be true. All right. Would be great. These are not established. However, also this proposal is unlikely, and one reason why it is unlikely is perhaps just observation, right? From cosmological observations, we get quite a lot of evidence for the fact that we have been in a period of slow roll inflation, and we roll down to our new minimum. So we've been rolling around in something, well, what, in a potential, right? So slow roll points to the fact that some effective potential exists, right? Along which we roll down into a new minimum. So if that exists, well, okay, then you know, you get sort of the general picture confirmed, and in particular, since all these possibilities arise in string theory, you expect that the potential is not just this simple thing with one minimum, but a very complicated thing with, you know, many minima. And you know, this thing is one-dimensional, but in principle it could be extremely high-dimensional with an enormous amount of this minima, right? Once you believe there is one, especially since this one, you know, has this extremely ridiculously small value of the potential at its minimum, right? 10 to the minus 120 and Planck to the fourth. If there's just one, again, you face the problem, like, why is that one then this at this extremely unnatural value, all right? Okay, so all this leads us to the working hypothesis, right? That there is indeed this huge configuration space of string theory in which there is some sort of effective potential with lots and lots of minima. And in order not to say every time again this huge configuration space, which is effective potential with lots and lots of minima, people have invented a fancy word for it, and that's what's called the landscape. Of course, this word is not new. It's used, you know, frequently in the context, for example, of quantitative biology, protein folding problems. You know, that people talk about the energy landscape of the protein. Before that, also in, you know, physics and statistical mechanics, early 20th century or something. So this has a long history. It's a very appropriate word in a way. In a way also a little bit misleading in string theory, but nevertheless stick to it. Okay. Well, at this point, some people get depressed. Some say, oh, well, this must mean string theory is wrong. Now, obviously, that's ridiculous. I mean, you know, if things are this way, well, then they are that way. Of course, it doesn't. The fact that a theory has an effective potential doesn't disprove the theory, right? Now, nevertheless, you can still keep on being impressed and say, well, okay, should we stop thinking, you know? Thinking about string theory as a theory of everything, as something that might explain us something about the world around us, and should we just, you know, go and find a different job? Well, the answer to these two questions is no, and the aim of these lectures will be to try to convince you of that. All right. Good. Well, one obvious thing that, you know, you could keep on thinking about, and probably people will keep on thinking about that for a long time, is, well, given all this fact, you know, is there maybe some magical selection principle that perhaps selects out one vacuum or a few vacua? Now, this may very well be possible. So we, of course, don't know much about the dynamics of string theory, let alone, you know, early time cosmology and those things were, well, that are important, obviously, for selection principles. So we don't know at this point, but definitely nothing comes, you know, the proposals come even close in really selecting one or a few vacua. Okay. Now, however, there is a sort of opposite possibility, which is in a way quite fascinating. And that is that, you know, we haven't selected just one vacuum, but actually all vacua, at least an enormous amount of them, are all realized in the universe. Now, since this word, well, since enormous sort of clashes with the uni in universe, people have, you know, invented the name multiverse for that. But, well, up to you if you think that's a good name. Now, okay, you can say these words, but can they, you know, be really realized in a physical theory? I mean, is there some mechanism that actually might achieve that? Yeah. And it turns out there is, and this can also be embedded in string theory. So what is the idea? The idea is sort of that it's basically unavoidable that this is the case. Namely, say you start, well, say take a simple model, right? With an effective potential, just one scalar, two minima, one a bit higher than the other. Yeah. And say that we start with some universe in the first vacuum. So since the cosmological constant is positive, the universe will be inflating at a crazy rate, bigger and bigger and bigger. But now, as you know, of course, from quantum mechanics, you can get tunneling between vacua, and the same thing can happen here. And how does it happen? Well, basically, at a certain point, randomly, a bubble forms of the new vacuum, and this bubble will expand at the speed of light. The boundary of this bubble is a domain wall between these two vacua. Yeah. So this is pretty well understood purely in quantum field theory by from work by Coleman and De Lucia, for example. Now, this, you know, was a case with the two vacua. Very interesting. But now, if you look at cases with like 10 to the 300 vacua, well, then the game, the show starts, right? Because, should I drop it? So, let's say you have 10 to the 300 vacuum. So you first get a bubble of vacuum 2, but then inside this bubble of vacuum 2, you can get new bubbles, vacuum 3, and then here, say, vacuum 4, and then here perhaps again vacuum 3, and so on, bubbles in bubbles in bubbles. Mind you, as long as the cosmological constant in these bubbles stays positive, so not only are these bubbles expanding or these walls expanding at the speed of light, but they're also inflating, right? So these spaces, if you want, grow exponentially, and it can be shown actually that these bubbles will never touch each other, right? So they don't percolate. They just, you know, are on their own, causally disconnected, and you just create more and more and more vacuum. So you get some crazy fractal structure, right? Because it's like iterated and iterated and iterated, and well, this presumably has been going on forever, so you get a pretty complicated thing there. Yeah. So this gives a mechanism to realize this idea, and as we will see later more concretely, this can also be very nicely and very naturally be incorporated in string theory as observed by Busso and Polchinski. Yeah. No, so, well, the values of the lambdas, for example, will, so the differences will determine, for example, domain wall tensions, also the probability of nucleation. It's just like, or very similar to ordinary tunneling, right? If the, you know, if this one is much deeper, the probability to tunnel becomes higher, and so on. So there is definitely some dependence. Oh, yeah, and one thing I forgot to mention, if some vacuum is a negative cosmological constant, what you'll get is actually, so you won't get like ADS space or something in there. What you get is actually a big crunch. So cosmologically, you get negative cosmological constant. Space basically collapses, which makes things even more complicated. And it's not clear that you can really make sense out of such a space-time in you know, geometrical terms. But in any case, this is the picture. Yeah. Okay. Now note, however, if you have so many vacua and you look at the values of the cosmological constant in each of these vacua, this being zero, well, you get this incredibly fine discretion of possible values, which perhaps these are excluded because they crunch very quickly into a singularity. But in any case, you get this discrete but very finely spaced range of values, which has been called discretium. Yeah. And in particular, just because there are so many, there will be also quite a lot that are as ridiculously small as our cosmological constant, right? If it's roughly uniform, then you could get, you know, if you have 10 to the 300 vacuum, you expect cosmological constants as small even as 10 to the minus 300. So you can easily accommodate a very small cosmological constant. And suddenly, you know, if you believe in this picture, it's perhaps not that incredibly amazing anymore that we observe such a small cosmological constant, right? Because of course, we are going to be in one of these bubbles where we can be, where galaxies are formed, and so on. So what this teaches us is that perhaps we shouldn't be, you know, too surprised by this, and perhaps not spend our entire lives to try to find some deep dynamical mechanism that explains the small cosmological constant, because, well, we can only be where we can be. Now, this is what is often referred to, you know, as the entropic principle. Many people think it's absolutely disgusting. For that reason, it has been rebaptized into the structural principle or the environmental principle. But it is what it is, and you know, even if you think it is disgusting, it is a logical possibility, right? And I would say it's probably at this point the only logically possible explanation for the smallness of the cosmological constant that fits perfectly within string theory. So you definitely have to take into account that possibility. All right. So similarly, you know, this surprise or this coincidence of having the electroweak scale exactly in that window, well, is again perhaps not so surprising anymore when you have that picture. All right. Now, once you have such a mechanism, you might think, oh, well, but maybe now I can start working, like, you know, in statistical mechanics, where you also sort of randomly, ergodically run through systems with many degrees of freedom, and maybe I can do statistical predictions. Yeah. All right. Well, so that would be really great, but it turns out to be technically very complicated to figure out probabilities based on this picture. You know, it's not clear exactly how to do it. You know, keep in mind these things are inflating, these volumes are getting bigger and bigger, so should we actually try to compute regions with the biggest volume, vacuum with the biggest volume? Well, maybe, but even that, because of this fractional nature of this space-time, is sort of an ill-defined problem geometrically. Maybe there's another prescription, but it just, at this point, not clear, unfortunately, how to do it exactly. Well, fortunately, though, there are easier questions that can already be answered at this level. So easier questions. But such as, for example, well, you know, Simplestone is, you know, in a given string compactification, do we indeed get a sufficiently fine spacing to accommodate the cosmological constant of 10^-120, right? So, more generally, I've been talking about the cosmological constant, but you could also look at other values like the weak scale or various coupling constants. You could, you know, put in more observational constraints. And again, you know, you'll get discrete you are in these parameter spaces. So more generally, what you would be interested in is compute distributions of vacua over parameter space. That, for example, would also tell you, you know, if you and compute how finely they are spaced, would tell you how precisely you would have to measure parameters in order to distinguish, for example, between the vacuum. Okay. And from these distributions, by integrating them, you can also get just the total number of vacua with a certain property, for example. Okay. So if you find, for example, that, you know, there are 10^100 vacua with property A, and there's only one vacuum not with property A, well, then no matter what the precise prescription will be, it's plausible that the most likely outcome will be vacuum with property A. Of course, you're never entirely sure. So these things are even better than if you find this way that there's no vacuum with property A. Well, then you definitely have a fair prediction there. But anyway, so the upshot is it is useful to look at these distributions, also because they give you know some general insight in what this landscape looks like. Okay. So this is then what is often referred to as statistics of vacuum. Even though the term is a little bit misleading, it's not connected at this point to real probabilities. It's more number densities, counting, and those things. Right. Okay. Oh, you would. It could be some other theory, you mean? Oh. Okay. Right, but the matter in the matter is a well, you know, as usual in also in quantum field theory, matter is sort of described as just some ripples on the vacuum. It's some perturbation of the vacuum. And the vacuum is sort of what gives you the large scale structure. And matter is basically just a perturbation of that. That is a framework people usually think in. Maybe that's wrong. Who knows? Maybe there's the key. But sorry? That's right. Well, if matter hadn't been there, the cosmological constant would still be the same, for example. Or if we hadn't had, you know, 10 to the I don't know how many electrons in the universe with just one, the mass of the electron would still have been the same. And so these things, the mass, cosmological constant, and so on, those are what you think of as properties of the vacuum. The numbers of particles, well, obviously, it's not a property of the vacuum. It's a property of the particular excited state of the vacuum in which we do happen to live. But we do not live in, of course, we do not live in a vacuum, right? But I don't think it's relevant for any of the these things. But I don't know. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So that's why I said, like, well, okay, you know, even if you have 10 to the 100 against 1, you still don't know for sure, as long as you don't know absolute probabilities. So that's why I said, well, actually, with the same techniques, you may also be able to show that there are no vacuum with a certain property. That may actually be easier using statistical approaches often than using exact construction. So in that sense, it would still be useful. Of course, if you only want to do statistics and counting and these things, if you only want to do statistics in order to do probability predictions, well, then you're absolutely right. But so the other point I made is, and that sort of fits with this, is you can also compute these distributions, for example, to figure out if indeed this discretion is sufficiently finely spaced, right? If there is really a vacuum within a certain ensemble that has a sufficiently small cosmological constant. I mean, a priori, you don't know that. And not every compactification of string theory, for example, will give rise to a sufficiently finely scanned discretium. So from that point of view, well, it depends. You know, if you, it's like, well, always with probabilities, right? I mean, there is, in principle, quantum mechanics says there is a probability that this chair will jump up, kick me in the face, jump down again. That's a possibility. If that happens, well, you could say, well, you cannot conclude anything because, you know, there was this infinitely small probability and it just happened. But I'm going to be thinking, well, if that happens, you know, somebody must have been standing there and kicked it in my face. So, you know, you never know for sure, of course, probabilities, but they give you a pretty good indication usually. If something is extremely unlikely, well, then, and it happens, then it's a good hint that there must be a better explanation. But, yeah. Sorry? Glossy modes? Glossy modes, yeah, it's somewhat, there's some similarities, yeah. Very sharp, what? Well, yeah, they can be extremely stable. I mean, the formation of such a bubble can, you know, take 10 to the 100 years or whatever, or you know, much longer than the lifetime of the universe, for example. I mean, hopefully, otherwise, you know, you'd be in serious danger. So, but of course, if you have forever, well, then that's long enough to make all these things happen. So, the dynamics of. Yeah, yeah. So, well, there are some estimates. I'm not going to talk about that, but for example, in Busa-Polchinski paper and in KKLT paper, there are some estimates. Obviously, it's not, you know, extremely well under control, all these things, but yeah, it can make it happen. Yeah. Yeah, but we will never see the domain wall because it's, you know, it's moving away at the speed of light, but it, yeah. We wouldn't notice, no, not for us, no. Yes, that's possible, but it would be wonderful. But at this point, there's no indication that that's the case. But right. Well, yeah, but, you know, we have pretty good experimental evidence that effective field theory is quite a good framework to work with. So at the energies that, you know, are relevant for us. But absolutely, yeah, this is. But of course, well, these are very, you know, interesting discussions. But let's. Well, I always like to quote Abdus Salam on this. He was paraphrasing Kennedy. Don't ask what the theory can do for you, but what you can do for the theory. So. So let's see what we can do for the theory then.
All right, so
So before we get into some real computation, there's one additional semi-metaphysical observation I would like to make. And that is, well, okay, you might say, well, why don't we just work the other way around as it has always worked? And why don't we just, you know, do a lot of observations, very precise observations, and then from those observations, you know, measurement of parameters, try to figure out in which string vacuum we live, all right? So that's the last possibility. It's more conservative if you want. Observation of parameters. Okay. So these are continuous, right? So these are continuous. String vacua are characterized by discrete parameters, fluxes, and so on. So these are discrete. So I would say, well, if I can, you know, measure things sufficiently accurately, I should be able to figure out exactly what these discrete parameters are. Okay. Now, obviously, this is, you know, a hard problem. But just how hard you could want. Well, this is exactly the kind of topic that theoretical computer scientists think about. And so you have something called and complexity theory, just from in the simplest possible toy model of this problem in string theory, tells you exactly how hard it is, and that is NP hard. Okay, well, what's NP hard? Well, there is this very beautiful classification of number of problems, and well, the simplest set in a way is the P set, and P stands for polynomial. These are problems that, for a given input, can be solved in polynomial time in the length of the input. Right, so it's a P of polynomial. So an example of this is multiplication. Right, give you two numbers of a certain length, I can multiply them. And the number of steps it takes me to multiply them is something polynomial in N. Now, there's a larger class of problems, and they are called NP. And that does not stand for non-polynomial. It stands for non-deterministic polynomial. So this, if you want, is deterministic polynomial. This is non-deterministic polynomial. What does this mean? These are problems that are such that if I give you a candidate solution, then you can check in polynomial time that this is a correct solution or not. Yeah. But not necessarily can you solve the problem itself from scratch in polynomial time. Right. So it's non. Okay. So efficient way to check it, not to solve it. An example of that is prime factorization. It's easy to check, well, you know, if I give you two numbers, then I say, well, these are two factors of this number. You can easily check that by multiplying them together. And of course, finding them is notoriously difficult. All right? Now, then there is a class of models, sorry, physics class of problems, and they're called NP hard. And those have the amazing property that each NP hard problem is such that you can reduce every NP problem to that problem in polynomial time.
Okay.
All right. So every single NP problem can be reduced to any NP hard problem in polynomial time. Okay, so it's quite amazing that these things even exist, but they do. Yeah. An example of an NP hard problem is, for example, if I give you a list of integers and ask you, well, find the subsets that, if you sum them up, are as close as possible to zero, or the closest to zero that you can get. And then finally, there's a class called NP-complete. And those are in the intersection of NP-hard and NP. All right. So NP-complete is, for example, the so-called subset sum problem. So if I give you a list of integers and I, then the question is, does there exist a subset of these integers? Such that they sum up to zero. So this is clearly in NP. If I give you a certain subset, you can, of course, quickly check if it indeed sums up to zero. But nevertheless, finding it is not simple. Now, which time is it? When did I start, actually, at 4 or 4:30? Ah, so half an hour, right? Yeah. All right. So it's actually one of the outstanding problems in theoretical computer science, or probably the outstanding problem in theoretical computer science, is to figure out if NP is actually different from P. So at this point, it is still possible that that the two are actually equal, although nobody believes it. Nobody has been able to prove it's not. Okay. Right. And all you would have to do to actually prove that is show that one of these problems can actually be solved in polynomial time, because, as you know, every other then can be reduced to that problem in polynomial time, and you don't. The whole thing collapses. Okay. But in practice, of course, NP hard problems are very hard, and they take a lot of time, and they can usually take, or they can often take exponential time. Okay. So why I'm saying all this? Well, it turns out that, for example, the problem, say, find the vacuum with the smallest cosmological constant, well, is definitely an NP hard problem, because, well, you can roughly see that it's somewhat similar to this problem, right? Because you're adding up, you know, you're turning on various fluxes and so on. I mean, I'll give more details of that. Adding up different energy contributions and so on, and you have to find the exact discrete combination of those that brings you the closest to zero, right? So it's quite similar in nature to that, and can actually be shown, indeed, to be in this class. All right? So all this tell you that maybe the whole quest to find the right vacuum of string theory is just mathematically impossible for us humans ever to achieve. Nevertheless, again, you can establish the existence of vacuum with certain properties using, you know, more non-constructive techniques. And so again, you know, by computing distributions and so on. So, for example, say, if I want to figure out if at least there exists some vacuum in a certain small region around a data point, yeah, well, I can compute the distribution, some approximate distribution. I can integrate that over that region. And if I find that that number is very large, from my theoretical computation, then it's, of course, very plausible that there will be vacuum in there. And again, or and sorry, and even in some cases you can prove that there will be some in there.
Okay.
Okay, so this slight detour in complexity theory, just to give another motivation why it can be useful to study statistics rather than direct construction. All right, so after all this semi-philosophy, let's do some honest computations. And see where we can get. Yeah, that would be okay. That would be the most straightforward algorithm to just try them all out, right? Now, there are more more efficient ways, and in particular, well, of course, it's a whole industry, right? I mean, like all of computer science is working on things like that. So in particular, there are algorithms that will give you a solution that may be wrong with a certain probability. So. Yeah, but it doesn't work that way. It's not a one-to-one map. That's the thing. These things are it's hard to imagine because our intuition is like about low-dimensional systems, and you know there these things are often all easily done. But so for example, even the problem like look at a very high-dimensional lattice, and I take just embedded in some space, I take some arbitrary point in the space, and then I ask, what is the lattice vector that is closest to that point, right? And I think, oh, well, that should be easy. Well, again, that's NP hard. So, a priori, I think, well, what's the problem? But there is indeed a problem. It's not that straightforward. Sorry, say that again. For example, say that you find some good selection mechanism or something like that. Perhaps that would reduce the set of possibilities and like what the modification would have to be. I think in theory, yeah, you could. Yeah. Another thing is, of course, you can put this, a lot of these problems can actually be solved more efficiently using a quantum computer, right? Like prime factorization and those things. So the fact that if a problem cannot be solved in when I say a problem cannot be solved in polynomial time, for example, I mean using conventional algorithms with a quantum computer, I mean, things are very different. And so maybe who knows, to find the right vacuum of string theory, you would have to build a quantum computer. Now, we might have to build a quantum computer the size of the universe to achieve that, which in a way the universe is, of course. Anyway, we're getting, yeah. Well, that's another difficulty, of course. So, in a certain given model, a classical model, you could, but then, okay, there are quantum corrections, especially after supersymmetry breaking and those things. So, you would have to compute those as well, and you might wonder, well, it may well be that the complexity of that task is even worse than that. So, that's right. As soon as you have fluxes and a large. Well, there, in the standard model, we only, we do not match an a priori set of possibilities apart from the gauge groups then to the output. So for example, there's no discrete property of the standard model that we have figured out by measuring a continuous parameter. So it's a totally different problem. We just, you know, figured out the gauge group. We measured directly the gauge group if you want. And then the parameters are just continuous, right? I mean, it's the input. Yeah. So that's, the difference with string theory is that this is a priori set, discrete set of vacua, and people hoped it would work differently, but my point is this might be very difficult, but not excluded. These are just the challenges, of course. No challenges, no research, no fun, so who knows what will happen over the next years. All right. So a very important step in this, the birth of this whole landscape idea and so on, was put by Busso and Polchinski. So in a way, this sort of first embedded the ideas I've been talking about into string theory. So let me sort of review what they did, because it's a very, well, it's a very basic, simple model of basically all these statistical methods that have been developed over the past years. And it's simple enough not to be bogged down by all the technical details of various constructions. So, all right, what's the idea? They say, well, let's say the cosmological constant is given by some bare cosmological constant, some negative bare cosmological constant, plus then a contribution from fluxes. So say, Okay, so this could be any string theory which has fluxes, VRR fluxes in type 2. This could be fluxes in M theory. It doesn't matter. The point is that these fluxes come with a large set of discrete degrees of freedom, if you want, because they are quantized. And so if you choose a basis of integral harmonic forms of the same degree as this flux, then you can expand this in a basis, and this gives you a number of integers and alpha, where alpha, let's say, runs from 1 to k, and k can be pretty large, can be 100, can be even 1,000, depending on the compactification manifold. All right, so using that expansion, you can rewrite this as 1/2 times some scale, m to the fourth, times some metric determined by the moduli, times an alpha and beta. Right. So this, and in principle also this, depends on the moduli. But Busso and Polchinski said, well, let's just forget about that. Let's assume they're frozen. And let's then just count vacua, consider vacua just to be given by these choices of n. Right. So back in those days, moduli stabilization was still very poorly understood. So that was definitely as good as they could do. Yeah. But in principle, I want to emphasize, of course, it's wrong, right? These depend on the moduli, so you should find. This is a potential, if you want. So you should find minima and so on, and it just complicates the problem. But let's just take this as our model. All right. Okay. So this, in principle, is also moduli dependent. Oh yeah. So you might wonder why, where does such a bare negative cosmological constant come from in string theory? Well, that could come from, for example, orientifold planes, which have a negative tension, or it could come from curvature of the internal manifold, which will also give a negative contribution to the energy. So this will be typically a large negative contribution of the order of fundamental scale to the fourth power. Okay, so what's the number of vacua then that have cosmological constant less than some cutoff value, lambda star? Well, that's simply the number. So what does this look like? You get a lattice, right? And so requiring lambda less than lambda star means that you have to stay inside this sphere in the lattice. Now, right, and it's really a sphere because this is positive definite, because this is positive definite. Right. Okay, so more precisely, sorry, it's the number of fluxes. And with 1/2 g alpha beta and alpha beta, that's equal to, less than, so this is equal to lambda naught plus lambda over m to the fourth, and that we require has to be less than lambda naught plus lambda star over to the fourth. Okay, so that's what gives this picture of the sphere. So that's the number of fluxes in sphere of radius. Okay, well, so let's call this thing here L. Okay, so then we have to count the number of lattice points in a sphere of radius square root of 2L, right? So I'll bring the 2 to this side, gives 2L. And of course, the radius is measured with respect to this metric G alpha beta. Yeah. Okay. So what is that? Well, of course, you can look up the formula for a higher dimensional sphere and, So this is, okay, you could count them all, of course, but if the sphere radius is sufficiently large, then you can approximate this number very well just by the total volume of the sphere, right? So approximately, this is just the volume of this sphere. So now you could look up this formula for the volume of a higher dimensional sphere, but let me remind you how you can easily compute that, because we will apply similar techniques than in situations where you cannot just look up the formula, you have to really compute it. So it's a good illustration of the basic idea. So how does it work? Well, you write that as the integral over n of theta of L minus 1/2 g alpha beta and alpha and beta, right? Where theta is the step function, so theta of x is 1 when x is bigger than 0, and it is 0 when x is less than 0. Okay. This is just a trivial mathematical translation of the volume of that sphere. So now you use a trick, very pretty trick. You write this theta function as some complicated contour integral, namely in this way, where the contour in the z-plane runs over the imaginary axis and passes zero, passes the pole from the right. Yeah, and so I have denoted n squared, well, g alpha, beta alpha, and beta just as n squared. Okay, so why is this true? Well, you see, if this is positive, yeah, then you can compute this contour integral by closing the contour to the left, right? Because then it's exponentially small on the left-hand side. And in that case, you enclose the pole, so you get 1. In the case that this is negative, you can compute it by closing the contour to the right. In that case, the pole is not in there, and you get 0. Okay, now, why is this a good thing to do? This is a good thing to do because it turns the problem just in the computation of a Gaussian integral, which, of course, as physicists, we are conditioned to solve in a fraction of a millisecond. So take out this integral, and you can take out this, ZL, and inside you're left with minus 1/2 g alpha beta and alpha and beta times z. Okay. Now, all right. This is easily done, right? It gives you pi to the k over 2 pi to the k over 2. Even divided by square root of determinant of g. Oh, and there's a z, of course, 2 pi well, times z to the k over 2. And now you simply do this integral here. Yeah. And that for L positive, at least, gives you, well, for simplicity, you can just assume k is even. The result you get then is still valid for k odd. So for k even, it's very simple. You just, you know, expand this out, and you see what. Sorry, this is minus, right? So the power here has to match with the power here when you expand this out, and so that gives you. And you get a term ZL to the k over 2 over k over 2 factorial. That gives contribution. And so you get simply L to the k over 2 over k over 2 factorial. Right. If k is even, if k is odd, you just replace the factorial by the appropriate gamma function. All right. Very good. Now, oh, g alpha beta was this metric that was induced by this scalar product. So it's, you know, you expand this, and then g alpha beta by definition is sigma alpha wedge star sigma beta. So this is some metric on flux space, if you want, which is moduli dependent, but we have frozen the moduli, so it's just some given metric. Yeah. Okay. Now, so now we can ask this $1 million question. Well, will we get in this discrete gym of vacua, will we get a cosmological constant that is sufficiently small, you know, to accommodate R? No, it doesn't, because of the star. It may depend, for example, in type 2b, it depends only on the complex structure. It doesn't depend on the Kähler moduli, it depends on the complex structure. Yeah. It depends. So it depends on the setting. And well, to compute this, you need a metric. And the metric depends on the moduli. So well, in type 2B, as it happens, it doesn't depend on the Kähler moduli. One way to, well, for example, it doesn't depend on the volume in that case, because this is a, in that case, type 2B would be a tree form and a tree form, and that's a scale invariant. So, but we'll get to more concrete cases. Yeah, very good. All right. So that gives you the total number of vacua with lambda less than lambda star. Now, what we're really interested in is, of course, the number of vacua with lambda between 0 and some small number epsilon. But that's now easily computed from this result, simply by taking the derivative of this cumulative function. So number of vacua, 0 less than lambda less than epsilon is dn d lambda times epsilon, and then, well, to see how this, well, this L had this 1 over n to the fourth. Right, so it gives you epsilon to the fourth, which has to be there for dimensionful reasons, of course, as well. And this has to be evaluated then at lambda equals, well, if epsilon is small, you can just take lambda equals 0. So that means L, because L, what was L? L was this, so that will be lambda naught over m to the fourth. So that's simply then given by 1 over square root of the determinant, and then the derivative, which is 2. In a canonical, yeah, that's right. A shortcut? It's possible, yeah. I don't know. I have very limited mental capacity, so it's possible that this is it. No, but this is, well, yeah, this is microcanonical. I mean, that's what we're doing. We're really counting, you know, we're not weighting by a Boltzmann factor or something. All right, so you see, oh, I forgot the epsilon over n to the fourth. So you see, even if this is, you know, very small, 10 to the minus 120 m Planck to the fourth divided by this flux scale to the fourth, then provided, so if lambda naught, right, is much bigger than the scale m to the fourth, such that this becomes very large. And even on top of that, k is also very large. The number of fluxes is very large. Then you see you can get a huge number here. Yeah. You know, you can easily get 10 to the hundreds, indeed, for k of the order of 100, that is like thousands or whatever. So I leave it to you to play around with the numbers and to figure out, you know, what sort of the conditions are on these relative scales and on the number of fluxes to get to this desired value. But in any case, if this is true, then this is easily satisfied. Just because in a big high-dimensional sphere, there are many lattice points. Okay. So now observe, though, that if this bare, so if the bare cosmological constant is of the same order as the mass scale of this flux contribution, or the fundamental scale of that, then it doesn't work. Yeah. Now, as Busso and Polsinski argue, you can actually tune the moduli for example, the volumes in M theory, such that indeed lambda naught is, you know, sufficiently above M to the fourth. So you just, you know, make some volumes big and you get some modest scale hierarchy. That's already enough. I mean, it doesn't have to be hugely above it, you know, like a factor of 100 or 10 probably would be fine already. All right, so then in that case, we're in business, okay? So the cosmological constant can relax the desired value. So note that, of course, still also in this problem, finding which would be, for example, the minimal value of the cosmological constant above zero would still be an NP-hard problem. But in any case, at least we have shown that it exists, okay? So to conclude then, well, what are the shortcomings, the main shortcomings of this picture? Oh, yeah, and something I forgot to mention. So here in business, I said, so this bubbling of new vacua and so on, in this case, is produced by nucleation of membranes in four dimensions, which could come from M5 brains in M theory or D brains in string theory. So these give domain walls in between, indeed, in between which indeed the flux jumps, and by nucleation of those, which was investigated initially by Brown and Teitelboim, by nucleation of these membranes, you can jump from one flux vacuum to the other, and if that goes on for eternity, you eventually sample all possible vacuum. Right, well, that's probably yeah, probably there's an easy way, but I'll finish up my lecture and then we can try to find an easy way together, because it's, I've got a couple of minutes and a couple of words, so okay. So this is all nice. The main shortcomings, though, are the fact that, you know, they assumed that this G alpha beta is fixed and frozen, all moduli are frozen. What we really have to do, so. What we really have to do is take that into account, and we have to find, you know, the moduli Z. So for each, you know, we have to look at all possible fluxes, all n. For each of them, compute a potential, which is this cosmological constant, right? Which will also depend on the moduli. Then find the modulus Z for which the potential is at a critical point. And, well, if you want a metastable vacuum, then you also want the second derivative to be positive definite mass matrix. Yeah. And then evaluate the cosmological constant and then look at all possibilities. So that's what we really have to do. Also, this lambda naught has to be made more precise. See if that doesn't depend on the moduli and all these things. So this looks like, you know, pretty complicated thing to do, right? And so you might wonder, well, you know, can we actually do it? And the question is yes, and that I will let you in on during my next lecture. So, thanks.
Okay, so since today I'm the only student speaker because nobody else wants to talk, we've decided that I'll start talking right now and we can all get home at 6:15. So for those of you who don't care about this talk, just go away. And for those of you who have
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I think it is. Well, let's see. So then, I don't think so because the.
So let's get started, and at 6:15 we can